Mark Bless. Hey, how you doing? It is August 20th, 2013, and it's time for It's All About Food. So what's going on with you? You got some good food stories? Why don't you share them with me at info@realmeals.org? You know I love talking about food. I love hearing about food. And so let's just keep talking about it. Now, today is very important because we are going to be talking about a kind of food that I don't think gets the press it deserves. So let's bring on my first guest, Kathy Hester, who has come out with the book, The Great Vegan Bean Book. And we are going to talk about the wonderful properties of beans. And I've learned a few things from this book. So, Kathy, thank you for joining me on It's All About Food.
I'm happy to be here, especially talking about beans.
Especially talking about beans. You know, there's a lot of things people have to say about beans, but I don't think we're focusing on all the right things. But we're going to do that in the next half hour because beans, well, I'm reading in your PR information, just maybe nature's perfect food.
I think they're kind of magical, so I think they might even be a little bit beyond perfect.
Beyond perfect. You know, we've heard for too long that the egg is a perfect food or milk is the perfect food, and we're really off the mark there. There's so many issues with those foods.
But absolutely.
But the bean. So people may be shaking their heads like, what are you talking about? But we are now going to tell you why beans are so magical. So where do we begin? Why did you write this book?
Well, why I wrote it was actually the publisher was looking for a bean book, and I love to learn about things. So I was like, sure, I'll do a bean book. I can find out all kinds of cool things. And obviously, I've been vegan for a few years, but I've been vegetarian before that for about 35 years. So I've been eating a lot of beans.
Mm-hmm.
And at first, people tend to think that they're kind of boring.
Right.
And that was one thing I really wanted to kind of take off the table, because beans are only as boring as the person cooking them. Like my, so
I might steal that
bean.
From you. Your cooking is only as boring as you are.
Even, I mean, to me, even just like Crowder peas and rice with a little bit of hot peppers and some sauce, that's pretty exciting to me. You know,
mm-hmm.
It's not a boring flavor.
Okay, so let's just start. One of the great things about beans, not only are there like a gazillion different kinds, and we'll get into that, but they're cheap.
Yes.
They're affordable. And they are super nutritious.
It's true. And they're so affordable. Of all the things you can start buying organic, usually common beans are the cheapest ones to start with, and they're easy to find now.
Mm-hmm.
You can even find them in a regular grocery store, organic lentils, organic pinto beans, things like that.
Now, there are different ways to start with beans, and you talk about them in your book. You can get them dried, and there's different ways to prepare them when they're dry, and you go into pretty good detail about soaking or not soaking, inspecting and rinsing, and all the issues. And if people want to know more about them, they should get this book and find out, of course. And then occasionally I'll grab a can of beans because it's so quick.
I think it's really important to have a few things stashed away in your pantry that you can make just at the spur of the moment. Because
mm-hmm.
beans, unless you're cooking lentils or you're using a pressure cooker, you kind of have to think dried beans a little bit ahead of time. They can be just as easy as throwing dried beans in a slow cooker while you're sleeping, so it's not hard work. But if you just come home and you realize, oops, I didn't plan anything for dinner, you can grab a can of chickpeas and what you can make is pretty endless. You can make hummus. You can make a salad with chickpeas. You can make a chickpea stew. You can make all these things really probably in less than 20, 30 minutes.
Now, just like a lot of foods that we find in the stores in the United States, the big agribusiness has kind of limited what's available. And most people don't even realize all of the different varieties of foods that are out there because they don't see them in the supermarket unless you go into an ethnic market where a specific community is bringing in from their country something that's familiar to them. And that applies to beans because people may be familiar with a brown lentil, a navy bean, a kidney bean, but there are so many different beans out there.
And it's amazing. One of my favorite places to go is the Indian market. So if you have an Indian market near you, just to walk down the spices and the beans is an education all in itself.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Because they're so clever with beans, and they have every kind. There's whole beans with skin, whole beans without skin, split beans with skin, split beans without skin that all get used in a little bit different function. For heirlooms, which are really cool, but they are more expensive. If you've never seen any heirloom beans, maybe at your farmer's market, to take a look at ranchogordo.com and just kind of peruse them, it's kind of mind-blowing.
Mm-hmm. And they all can be prepared very similarly, but just like anything, they have their own unique characteristics. Some are chewier, some are mushier, some have a stronger flavor, some have a mellower flavor, and they're all worth experiencing.
Right. And garbanzo beans are kind of like almost the most special of all beans because they just hold together so well under any circumstances. So it's interesting that there's so many different kinds of lentils and so many different kinds of regular beans, but chickpeas kind of stand alone.
Okay. Now, one of the things that surprised me, and then I made a big duh when I was looking at it in your book saying, of course, but you bake with beans and
yes,
make sweet and savory baked goods.
Well, it's awesome because a lot of my readers are looking for low-fat to no-fat baked goods, so I try to make recipes for everybody. And when you're doing something with a baked good, you want to make sure that you're not using $5 or $6 a pound beans because you're not going to taste them. So using just some plain white beans, if they're navy or Great Northern, just really any white beans you get your hands on, the flavor is really very mild.
Mm-hmm.
So in a waffle or a pancake, you don't taste the beans at all. And actually, I had a bean hater over because we kind of had the year of beans at my house. So everyone who came over knew there were beans in something. They just weren't sure what. And so I finally, the bean hater was halfway through the waffle, so I said, you know, I have to tell you, there are beans in there. She had no idea, and she immediately stopped eating it.
Oh, how
so it was so
silly.
Sad.
How childish. Yeah.
We all have our things, so that yeah. was her thing.
Well, you know, I guess if I was eating a waffle and somebody said there was, like, dog milk in there, I would stop eating it, too.
Yeah. I guess I have trouble seeing beans as being that gross because most of the time people who are anti-bean, they don't like the texture or they don't like the flavor or how something has been prepared. When I grew up, I wasn't a bean lover because I grew up in the South, so we had pintos cooked with fat back and raw onions on top, which is not real kid-friendly food.
Right. The thing that surprised me is I got into gluten-free baking a few years ago. No, I'm not gluten intolerant, but I just wanted to provide more recipes that were vegan and gluten-free. I love to bake, and I didn't want anyone that couldn't have gluten not be able to bake and bake vegan. And I've learned a great deal, and I'm having a lot of fun with it. But I started to discover these bean flours, and I bake a lot with garbanzo bean flour and fava bean flour, and why not use the original bean? Why do you have to even go to the flour? That's when I went, wow, I got to start putting beans in my baked goods.
Now, here's the trick, though. If you're making something sweet, don't taste what's in the food processor before mm-hmm. you add sugar, because I always do what I tell everybody else not to do, because I'm like, oh, is this going to work? And then I'm like, this is disgusting.
Yeah.
And because it doesn't taste like a sweet yet. As soon as you put some vanilla in there and your whatever your sweetener is, it's perfect.
Well, when I cook with garbanzo bean flour, even if you sweeten it, it's disgusting until it's baked. That's just, you just have to know that when you're doing some gluten-free baking and you're using bean flours. There's just a, it's just a beany flavor. How else to describe
it? Well, that's
the
beauty of it.
But when you're doing a batter, it's not what you expect.
It's true. I guess whenever I think of chickpea flour, I always think back to pakoras, which is the first way I was introduced to it. And its flavor is just so delicious when it surrounds a nice fried veggie.
So just to just quickly review, get people's mouths watering, there are black bean tamale muffins and lemon coconut chickpea muffins and waffles, and somehow you've magically and put beans in all these recipes, savory pancakes. So I can't wait to try some of these. And then, well, now let's just move on to the purees, the dips and things. Now, fortunately, over the last, I don't know how it happened, maybe the last 20 years, but hummus has really gained some stature in the American diet.
It's true. It's the one saving grace. Whenever you go out anywhere and you're vegan or vegetarian, there's always hummus now.
Yeah. And hummus, well, the funny thing about hummus is hummus means chickpea, means garbanzo bean. That's how they say it in Hebrew and some other languages, hummus. And now we started to make hummus with other beans. It really isn't hummus anymore. It's a bean dip. But people need to know that there's more variations on bean dip than hummus. Hummus can be wonderful, but widen your horizons.
Well, it's always easier, too, if someone like you or I is willing to experiment and see if it works out or not first.
Mm-hmm.
So
have you ever made a bad bean dip?
Not anything that couldn't be saved.
There you go.
Because
everything can always be saved.
It's true. Sometimes the best thing is a stew that doesn't taste quite right, and then you put six more things in, and it's perfect, and you never would have done it.
Yeah, that's right.
I guess I'm an optimist cook.
Well, you know, but that's really an important message, because there are a lot of people that are afraid of cooking. They don't know where their kitchen is. And then they have to find it and start cooking. And the thing is, we make mistakes. And that's the only way we learn. And many, many times with food, mistakes can be saved and turned into your most favorite dish.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I always tell people, if I can do it, you can do it.
Now, why is that?
Well, I taught myself how to cook, so mm-hmm. I kind of went through all the mistakes, and then if someone tells me not to do something and I don't have a clear understanding of why, I do it to see why. So I kind of make everybody's mistakes so you don't have to, you know? Like with slow cookers, I'm like, oh, it can't be possible to make that in a slow cooker. Let me try. And most of the time it comes out great.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess I'm kind of a rebel or something.
Okay.
Well, but if you wanted to talk, two of my favorite dips that I think are really kind of slightly unique, I don't know how unique they are in all the world, but I have a white bean pecan pate.
Mm-hmm.
And so the smoky quality of the pecans and a little bit of nutritional yeast pureed with the white beans, it's got a little basil, garlic, oregano.
Mm.
And it makes a really nice darker color spread from the pecans.
Is that the little southern touch we're getting there with pecans in it?
Yes, I am definitely a southern girl. It comes out often, like in my chickpea patties and cornbread waffles that are in the book, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, the wonderful thing about bean pâtés is for people that want to get away from cheese and don't know what to do, I think these different varieties are a great substitute. They're not going to taste like cheese. Some made with nuts, you have an almond cheese spread, here a faux goat cheese. Some of them are going to get a little closer if they have a little higher fat content. But just to have some kind of different flavorful spreads to dip in or to spread on something, I think really can take care of a lot of cheese addictions.
Oh, I completely agree. And when people are transitioning from one kind of diet to another or eliminating something, I think it becomes a little easier if they have something familiar, even if it's not exactly the same thing. Because these are things that you can spread on crackers while you have some grapes and wine, if that's something you're used to doing every once in a while.
Mm. Yeah. And it's a lot cheaper than cheese.
Yes, it is. Even though there's some nuts in these spreads, they're really like a quarter cup to a half a cup of nuts, which aren't that expensive.
Right. And the wonderful thing about nuts is they are loaded with great nutrients and no cholesterol. Okay. So let's move to the soup section. I think most people are familiar with beans in soups. But if you're not making any, there's a lot of different options in here to get your soup thing going.
One of my favorites is the New Year's soup with black-eyed peas. But the Indian split pea and mung bean soup was really a tester favorite, too.
I'm just turning the pages here, and I'm looking for Indian split pea and mung bean soup. Oh, New Year's soup. Now, it's New Year's because?
Southern, black-eyed peas, greens. Those are two things that you're supposed to eat on New Year's Day.
Look at that. I didn't know that.
I was surprised that, because I guess I grew up that way, and everybody I know that isn't from here knew that already. My editor didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. Well, we don't know everything, do we? Okay. and then back to the baking department, you've got a lot of different savory items with baking, different waffles that are savory, chickpea and cornbread and don't be crabby cakes. I like that one. So the bean is great. I remember there was a recipe that went around in a magazine or something somewhere that people got very excited about. It was a fettuccine Alfredo low-fat version without using cream. They used the white bean. And there was a big spin on this for a while. But the thing is that a white bean can be used in so many different recipes as a white creamy sauce.
Right. I actually have a vodka sauce that I do with white beans that's in the book. And another spread that I have is a white bean basil spread that I usually use lemon basil with. And I actually layer an eggplant lasagna with that instead of cheese.
Very, very good. Anyway, there's a lot of wonderful different things in here. Chili, of course. I mean, people know about chili, but there are still a gazillion ways to make chili and many other great beans, casseroles. You can put it in pasta. But I want to talk about some other things about beans. Now, people have some problems with beans. Can we talk about some of them? Now, I'm not afraid
Indeed.
To talk about some things, about the things that come out of us from different ends. And when people think about beans, a lot of people think about gas. Is there a solution for eating beans and not having gas from either end?
I think the number one problem is that a lot of people aren't used to digesting that much fiber, and it just causes them some gastric distress. And if they eat a little bit more, that helps. Now, once you've moved out of that category, there are people who do have more troubles with it. And it's obviously a worldwide thing because each country and area seems to have its own special thing that it puts with beans. Like kombu, bay leaves, epazote, cumin, summer savory, hing is also used a lot in Indian cooking, and they're all found to make the beans a little more digestible.
Ah, very good to know that. So we just need to add a little bit about that, but I think some people are just always going to have a little gas.
I think some people are, if you have a lot of problems, typically because I I'm a slow cooker fiend, so I tend to slow cook my beans. So I don't soak them because I want them to take a longer time to cook. But if you're having serious problems, I would soak the beans overnight, pour out the soaking water, cook them, and pour out the cooking water. You will lose some vitamins that way, but if you can't digest beans very well, you're still getting more than you would get anyhow.
I'm going to be talking in the next part of this program with Deidre Rawlings about her fermented food books, and I'm going to bring this subject up again because she's probably going to talk about how people that don't have healthy guts probably have a harder time digesting beans.
Interesting. She may have some great fermented food that's perfect to eat with beans, too.
Right, so stay tuned for that part. Now, the other thing that I find is when I eat beans, they have a lot of fiber in them, and I find everything moves quite easily all the way through my large intestine, small intestine, colon, and all the way out. I mean, I don't have any problem moving everything through from beginning to end when I eat my beans.
It's true. And with some of the sweet treats, I'm actually using flaxseed eggs.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important that you don't eat the whole batch of double chocolate devil's food cookies. I tested out a few cookies in a row one day, and I kind of messed up my partner really bad for a few days.
Oh, you think it was because there were too much flaxseeds, or?
Yeah, too much flax and too much fiber in the beans. She has some trouble with beans.
Right.
But
okay.
I felt horrible.
Oh well, you know, that's the thing. Too much of anything. I think if people ate too many white flour muffins, they'd really be quite constipated. So
right, it's the opposite problem.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Now, I had one more question about beans. Oh, I wanted to mention the resistance starch. Are you aware of all the conversations now about resistant starch and beans?
No. I know about the undigestible sugar, and it starts with a P.
Okay. Well, the resistant starch is something that's getting some attention, and it's just one more wonderful thing about beans, because we know that beans come with a certain amount of calories, and some people may be counting calories. I don't recommend it, but the resistant starch doesn't digest until way, way down at the end of the intestine, and you don't get the full calorie count of the beans as they are presented on a nutritional label. So you get full, but you're not even getting the calories that you think you're getting. You're getting less.
That's pretty interesting. I'm going to definitely have to look more into that,
mm-hmm.
because that's an interesting concept.
Well, that's why a lot of the vegan doctors today are saying you can eat pretty much as many beans as you want. A bean is an unlimited food because you'll get filled up before you consume too many calories. We love beans. Love beans. All right. Now, I want to get to the best part of the book. Saving the best for last. I'm looking at some of your frozen treats, which are amazing. Black bean fudgesicles. How did you come up with that?
I was trying to think of something unique to do, and I realized I love black bean brownies.
Mm-hmm.
And if black beans taste good in a brownie, they should taste just as good in a chocolate fudgesicle.
And they do.
And they did.
Yeah.
And so
it's crazy. There's just black beans, coconut milk, cocoa powder, agave, and a little vanilla.
Right, and you can switch out that agave to any sweetener that you like.
Mm-hmm.
And just, I recommend with all the desserts to switch it to whatever you like and just kind of taste the batter to make sure it tastes sweet enough for your taste.
Well, you don't add very much, 3 tablespoons for 6 pops. That's not a lot of sweetener.
No, I tend to be on the lower side of that, the same way I'm usually on the lower side of salt. Because
mm-hmm.
even though I have nutritional information, I don't in this book give any sodium information, because probably 90% of the recipes say salt to taste.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm all for that. I barely add any salt to my food. Salt is a no-no in my book. But people feel differently about it, and yeah, so you give them the option. If they need a little more salt, go for it.
And kind of the same thing with desserts. Some things I like to have sweeter than others, but for some reason, the black bean fudgesicles tasted real chocolatey and rich to me without very much agave.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And then there's the ginger red bean popsicles.
Yes, because I do have a recipe for red bean paste, which is a traditional Asian dessert, which is really interesting. And I'd had it in different pastries before, but I'd never made it. So I thought, oh, it's going to be complicated and have a lot of ingredients. It's water, beans, and sugar.
And a little ginger.
Yeah, and
in
so with
pops.
This one, then yeah, then the pops have coconut milk and ginger in them as well to kind of add to that. There's also a red bean filled muffin too that's pretty interesting. So if you make a whole batch, you can do the muffins and the popsicles.
Mm, very, very good. You see, beans are quite exciting. From baked goods to popsicles, you can do everything with beans. And I just want to just mention the soybean for a moment, because soybeans are, I believe, are a great food. There's a bit of hysteria around soybeans these days because, unfortunately, we've manufactured it into so many different foods and people have issues with it. But you do not have to eat soybeans. Even though they're just a lovely, simple bean, you don't have to have them. There are all these other wonderful beans out there, and you can do so many great things with them. So, Kathy, thank you for the great vegan bean book.
Thank you for inviting me on. I really appreciate it.
Yes, and we can find you at, you have a bunch of...
Healthy. Oh, sorry.
Yes, please go ahead.
I thought that was a cue.
Yes,
HealthySlowCooking.com.
HealthySlowCooking.com, where you blog, and you also blog at KeyIngredient.com.
I do. I'm the vegan blogger every Wednesday.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food.
Great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. That was Kathy Hester, the author of the great vegan bean book. I love beans, and I hope you learn to love them too, because they're going to love you and make you look wonderful. Shall we take a little break? And then we're going to be back with Deidre Rawlings talking about fermented foods, okay? Hey, everybody, I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food, and here we are in part two on August 20th, 2013, moving on to talk about... Well, we're going to get small here and talk about some very special microorganisms that can do wonders and learn a lot. So I'm going to bring on Deidre Rawlings. She holds a PhD in holistic nutrition, a master's in herbal medicine, and is a naturopathic doctor. She is the founder of Nutri Living and a healthy cooking coach. Her specialties are allergies, digestive disorders, and immunity issues. She is also the author of Foods That Fight Fibromyalgia and co-author of Beet Sugar Addiction Now cookbook. She lives in Atlanta, Georgia, and we are talking about her new book, Fermented Foods for Health. Welcome to It's All About Food, Deidre.
Hello, Karen.
Hello, and how are you today?
I'm doing great. Thank you very much for that lovely introduction.
Oh, you're very, very welcome. So we're going to talk about fermented foods, and I imagine you must be pretty busy these days because it seems like everyone today has allergies, digestive disorders, and immunity issues.
That's so true, and I tell you, the top five issues that people present with to most physicians these days is probably digestive issues, overweight, depressed, hormonal imbalances, and just insomnia. A lot of people having sleep disorders as well.
Right. Well, there are so many symptoms today that people have that could be just about anything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so many
it's so related.
So many different illnesses have similar symptoms. It's really, it can be really difficult to diagnose.
It really can. And a lot of them have roots in the digestive system, because this is where we're nourishing our entire organism, you know, the human body. And I think one of the problems is that we, well, the allopathic medical system tends to isolate the systems of the body. You know, we've got 10 in total, and you're sent to various different specialists for these different systems, you know, an internist or a cardiologist or whatever the case may be, and they don't talk to each other. And so they are only treating that special area that that's all they really know about, and they're not really integrating the whole body as a whole and looking at it from that perspective, a holistic perspective.
I liked in Chapter 2, you have a section, Your Body as a Social Network.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something I think people can relate to these days.
Exactly, and that's what these probiotics are. They're like friends with benefits, I call them, because they just have so many uses throughout the body, and particularly in the digestive system, which, as you know, I'm sure, is where 70% of your immune system resides. And so these little probiotics, these amazing little microorganisms, you know, they just do such a tremendous job of ensuring that we're healthy from, you know, the digestive and the immune systems upwards.
Now, we can get into a lot of different things, but what I find interesting is you go back in history and there are a lot of different cultures that have special traditional foods that are fermented, and how they knew they were healthy. And then we fast forward to the last 50 years where we're doing all of this industrial manufacture of foods and we're killing everything. And now we have all of these health issues and we're starting to almost rediscover what we need in our guts. We're just starting to learn about prebiotics, probiotics, bacteria, and it's just opening a whole new world of health and healing.
Mm-hmm. And the thing about fermented foods or lacto-fermented foods is that you're right, they have been around for eons. I mean, ever since the first piece of fruit fell on the ground and it started to bacteria started to ferment the product. And of course, you know, during the winter months when you can't get some of the same fruits and berries and foods that you could get during the summer months, the fermentation was such a wonderful way to preserve that food so that you could eat it throughout the various seasons. So, people are rediscovering it, and for very good reason.
All right, just some basics. So what is fermentation?
What is fermentation? That's a good idea, a good question. And basically, it occurs when the bacteria can be present in the food into cellular energy and lactate or lactic acid. And this lactic acid is a natural preservative that inhibits the putrefying bacteria. And the process is one of the most probably significant forms of fermentation in the food industry. You know, you've got examples like, you know, vegetable lactic acid fermentations include sauerkraut and cucumber pickles and kimchi and kefir and yogurt and buttermilk and cheeses and tofu, and even wine and chocolate is fermented to some degree or another too.
We see lactic acid a lot as a listed ingredient in manufactured foods, and I guess it works as a preservative to some extent.
That's correct. Yes, it does.
Okay. So that's what fermentation is. Now, we've been very socialized in the last 100 years or so to be very concerned about germs and wanting everything to be clean and wanting everything to be sterile. And to some extent, it's been beneficial, and to other extents, we're starting to learn that it's to our detriment. How do we know the difference between fermented food and rotting food?
Well, if you're going to be buying it in the store, you're certainly not going to likely to find the rotting food that's under the, you know, under the category of fermentation. But basically, you know, it has a really nice taste to it. I mean, it's very palatable. It's a very distinct sort of taste, fermented food. It's got that sort of sour, pungent sort of flavor to it, and it might take the palate a bit of getting used to because mm-hmm. we're so used to that sweet taste.
Mm-hmm.
But once you start to get your palate accustomed to it, it's very addictive almost. I mean, you start to crave it, and the right from when you take the first mouthful, I mean, you're helping the mouth to become freshened up, and it just as it goes down into your gut, into your starts to do its job, it just starts to feel so good. The benefits are pretty rapid once you start eating it. So, and of course, it won't have that same kind of putrefying smell that you would experience if you were to smell some food that was rotting. It just has just the look and the smell of it is it's very palatable.
Now, I've been reading quite a bit about bacteria because we're learning a lot more about it, and there have been some studies showing that some bacteria can play a dual role. It can be a good bacteria in some cases and a bad bacteria in other cases. I just find it really fascinating. Or that some bacteria that we need when we're really young then can wreak havoc in when we're older.
Mm.
And it's really fascinating. But the thing is, when we treat our body nicely, it knows what to do.
It totally does. And, I mean, the thing is that you can't avoid bacteria because that's what we live with here on planet Earth. I mean, it's in and on everything. I mean, even just a little pin dot has hundreds of thousands of bacteria living on them. And, of course, some of it's harmful and some of it's friendly. And in the human gut, for example, there's about 3 pounds worth of bacteria that lives in your body. And you want more of the friendly and less of the harmful. And when you have more harmful overruling the friendly, that's when you're going to get sick and your immune system is going to be compromised as a result of that. So you really can't avoid bacteria. It's just something natural. And the thing is that when you have a good supply of these friendly bacteria in your gut, you're going to be able to, they actually eat a lot of the pathogenic bacteria. And so it's natural that you're going to have some of these pathogenic kinds of bacteria that will pass through you, like the E. coli and some of these other bacteria that are on the food that you eat. It's on whether it's meat product, whether it's even a produce, a fresh fruit or vegetable, it's going to have some bacteria on it. But depending on the composition of your own gut bacteria, whether you've got more friendly than harmful residing there, you're going to have a much stronger immune system and be able to not be so affected adversely and get sick by any kind of harmful bacteria that passes through your body as a natural process of, eating and living.
In reading your book and when I'm reading other articles and books on this issue about the life going on inside of us, it's pretty amazing. There's a whole universe of all kinds of characters that are living within us, and you even have these discussions where it sounds like if we there are wars going on and we need to have a good army of healthy bacteria, otherwise the bad guys can take over.
Totally. And that's the difference between, two people can be exposed to the same set of environmental hazards or germs or whatever you want to call them, and one person can, come down with a horrific flu virus and the other person not at all. And why is that? Well, it's probably because they have a healthy supply of these friendly, their gut is in much better condition. It's in better shape because it's probably got more friendly bacteria residing there. And the thing is that with our Western diets as well, this is one of the things that's wreaked havoc on our immune systems and our digestive systems, of course, especially with all this high sugar and the high fructose corn syrup, which, according to some studies, the sugar can not only render your immune system or suppress it for up to 6 hours, but it can also alter the composition of the microflora for 24 hours later and do a lot of harm there. And probably suppress the immune system. So, you know, the one thing is it's not only what you eat, it's what you avoid, such as sugar, because the sugar is what feeds the pathogenic bacteria. I mean, you know, it feeds the candida,
right,
for example, with the yeast, and it feeds a lot of these other pathogenic bacteria. They love carbohydrates and sugary kind of foods.
It's like the good guys get drunk on sugar and white flour and processed food, and the bad guys take over.
That's a good way to put it. And then they go to town, and they make you feel lousy and give you, I mean, a lot of the symptoms that people are walking around with can be just, you know, the like, for example, candida, you have so many symptoms with it. Got fatigue, and you've got brain fog, and you've got aches and pains, and you know you can't sleep, and you're hungry all the time, and you gain weight. I mean, the candida will just, it mimics so many things. And once you restore that balance of the friendly microflora, that can all just be alleviated. I mean, benefits of probiotics are so immense. I mean, they nutritionally, they help manufacture vitamins in our foods and our bodies, like all the B vitamins, which are your stress vitamins, you know, vitamin A and vitamin K. They help to digest lactose. So, you know, they're so beneficial for your digestive system. Some people who are lactose intolerant, they can eat the yogurt and the cultured dairy products. They help to regulate the peristalsis in the colon and regulate your bowel movements. And they also help to digest protein as well, you know, which is really important to, you know, break it down into those free-form amino acids. And, of course, they boost your immune system. You know, they produce natural antibiotics and antifungals, which prevent the colonization of these harmful bacteria and fungus and what have you. And they also help to manufacture our essential fatty acids. And they even help to break down and rebuild hormones and just generally promote.
It's just amazing, and I think we don't even know about so many of the functions that they do. We're just at the tip of the iceberg learning. But I think what's very clear, and this is just one more way to look at it, processed foods are not healthy for us. We need to get back to whole, minimally processed foods, foods that are alive. And there are a lot of microorganisms in there that we don't want to kill. We want to consume them because they're good for us.
That's right. And a lot of these fresh whole foods that you mentioned, they contain a lot of vitamins and minerals, obviously, but they also contain fiber. And fiber is like what's called a prebiotic that these friendly probiotics need in order to thrive. And so you want to have your fiber and create that really fabulous environment to nourish the bacteria, the friendly bacteria, and help to, you know, keep everything just moving and healthy bowel movements and everything, you know.
Now, there's so many people are sick today, and diabetes, obesity is on the rise, and then this irritable bowel syndrome and Crohn's disease, lots of allergies, and you've probably seen this, I know I have, that when people start to change their diet, and probiotics are a very important piece, especially with irritable bowel syndrome and Crohn's disease, they can be cured.
They truly can. And if I had to recommend one supplement over and above everything else, it would be probiotics. And the thing about probiotics is that you can take them therapeutically or just prophylactically. And I recommend, you know, if you have any kind of digestive system disorder like IBS and Crohn's and colon, Crohn's and colitis and celiac and any of these kinds of things, that you should be on probiotics, and you should be taking them probably 3 times a day. The good thing about them is you can't overdose on them, not like a vitamin or a mineral or a drug, which you can overdose on. You simply can't. So, you know, just take them every day, and just it'll save you so much time and energy. It'll give you so much life and vitality, and it will just restore your digestive system, which is really where the action is at. You know, when you are properly absorbing and assimilating nutrients. This is what these probiotics are going to help you to do. And not only that, they also help to balance the body's overall pH by creating a more alkaline blood as well as an acidic environment in your stomach, which is what you want, because you want that hydrochloric acid in your stomach, which kills the pathogenic ones when they hit your stomach. I mean, your stomach is like your first line of defense, and you want to have a good supply of hydrochloric acid in there, and the probiotics will help to maintain that. And it's just, they're so conducive for a healthy digestive system.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I know most of us don't know anything about diet and how the body works, and there's been this buzz about eating foods that make the body alkaline. And, you know, I don't think most people remember their chemistry and understand what pH and alkaline and acid is to begin with, but when we talk about alkaline, as you mentioned, we're talking about the blood and the urine.
Yes. Well, moreover, we're talking about the blood, because the blood is the true barometer of the health of the, you know, the what, whether you, the pH level of your body. It's really the blood, and it's very delicate, because so you can't just kind of have a blood test every day to check it. But one of the ways we can check, get an idea, is through testing our urine. But the blood pH is very delicate. It likes to maintain a balance of between about 7.2 to 7.4. I mean, for those of you who aren't familiar with pH, it's basically the level of the hydrian pH in your body, and it's on a scale from 0 to 14, with 7 being in the middle. And anything 7 and above is considered alkaline, and anything 7 and below is, or below 7, is considered acidic. And, of course, there's different pH levels throughout the body. Essentially, the stomach is a very high acid area, which you want it to be, because that acid will kill off the pathogenic bacteria when it hits your stomach. And then the rest of the colon is pretty much pH and alkaline, and of course the blood is definitely between around about 7.2 to 7.4. So if you deviate from that, if you're eating too many chemicalized foods, sugary foods, devitalized foods, these are very acidic, and they are going to throw that pH balance out of whack. And your body is so intelligent that it's going to just take out certain minerals like calcium and magnesium, for example, that can help to buffer that pH and help restore it back to the delicate pH level that it's meant to be. However, in the process of doing that, it's going to rob that calcium out of storage places like bones and teeth. And, of course, you know, we're seeing a lot of people having osteoporosis, especially once women go through menopause, for example. We're seeing a lot of hip replacements, and, you know, all of these kinds of disorders or diseases are coming about because the pH of the balance of the body is, you know, it's out of balance because of the diet.
You've got a lot of recipes in your book, and, you know, people can go to the store and they can buy probiotics, but one of the great ways to get a lot of the great benefits of probiotics is to eat fermented foods. And so about half of your book is recipes that people can make, which is great. Here on It's All About Food, I promote a plant-based diet, so I'd like to focus on some of the wonderful fruit and vegetable recipes that you have in here. And just to mention, you do talk about yogurt and kefir, which is dairy-based, but you can also make those things from non-dairy milk.
And nut milks, absolutely.
Right. Yeah, I've made a bunch of yogurt from almond milk, and it's just fabulous.
It's wonderful, and you can make cashew cheese and ferment it, and even your the jams and preserves and things like that. I like to just ferment my jams and preserves, and talk about a taste sensation. I mean, it's and it just feels so good, and you know you're doing good for your body, and it just starts to move you away from that sugary, kind of addictive sort of sickening after a while, once you change your palate around that taste and really just, you know, I always say to people, even if you just have a mouthful a day of something that's fermented, and I say go with sauerkraut because it's got about 300 to 400 times more vitamin C than any other food. Mm. It's And that's all you need, and it's just, it tastes wonderful, and just that alone is like taking a dose of good dose of probiotics. Of course, you want to have a different lot of different sort of foods, and because they'll have different strains of bacteria, and we need to have a range of different bacteria to, you know, they only have a short lifespan. These bacteria only live about 10 days, which is like, you know, the course of a dose of antibiotics. When they put you on those, that's why they're only a short dose, because they're going to kill them within about, they're going to naturally die anyway in about 10 days to 14 days. And so even just having a mouthful of sauerkraut, put it on your salad, your raw salad every day, you will be giving yourself just a medicinal treat.
Now, a lot of people just like to buy stuff in the store. They're not very good at home. And I think there's some pluses and minuses about doing fermented foods at home. The thing is, you have to plan in advance. You can't just say, I think I want to eat fermented foods today. What's in the cupboard? Unless you go to the store and get something, because it takes about a week with some of these things. Or you could probably make a Rejuvelac in a few days. But these things take planning. But once you're in the mode of doing it, then it's there waiting for you.
Exactly. And it's such a treat. And like I said, you can get all the nice summer fruits and berries and stone fruits and what have you. And before they go out of season, you can just ferment them. And
okay, let's just get a quick little idea of what fermenting requires.
Oh, well, basically, it's not a lot. I mean, all you need is like a fermentation starter, which could be a whey, or sometimes with cabbage, you don't need anything to start. All you need is salt and water, and that's it. And the little microorganisms will do the job for you. As long as you've got the mason jar, you need like a screw-top lid. Some people use these airlock lids, which are a little bit more fancier, but you don't need to use those. But you just need a mason jar, some water and salt. And if you're going to use a starter, then you would get your starter ahead of time. But that's really all you need, because Mother Nature does the rest for you.
Now, I'm always concerned about salt in my food, and a lot of these fermentation processes require salt.
So you want to make sure that you're using a good quality, like a Celtic or a Himalayan salt. You're absolutely right. I mean, you don't want any of these table salts that are iodized or anything like that. Anything that's been devitalized in any way. So, yeah, you want to just have the good, healthy salts, and I recommend a Celtic or a Himalayan crystal salt, which I've recommended throughout the book and throughout the recipes.
Okay. And if I make a sauerkraut, let's say, and then I rinse it afterwards, does that have a negative effect if I want to try and get whatever salt is left over in it to make it less salty?
You don't have to use a whole lot of salt. And the thing is that, yeah, you wouldn't want to really rinse it because, well, certainly not using tap water, because it's got at least 2%.
I distill all my water.
Yeah, good. but it might diminish the probiotics there as well. So is there a reason that you would want to take
that?
I
don't salt my food. So when I get a little salt on something, I'm really sensitive to it.
Okay, yeah. Because your adrenal glands do need a little bit of that. But I think you're going to find that with the sauerkraut, it's going to be outweighed. Any salt flavor, it's going to be outweighed by that nice, pungent, sort of soury taste. And it's also going to have, you know, the high vitamin C, and it's going to bring out the flavor of the cabbage a whole lot more. And it's not going to really taste very salty, actually.
I had Kathy Hester on the first part of the show, and I said I was going to ask you a question that I'm going to do right now. So we were talking about beans, because her book is The Great Vegan Bean. And a lot of people complain about gas and other things when they're eating beans. Is this something that probiotics can help?
Yeah, the thing about beans is they have these, like, phytic acid in them. And in order to release the enzymes in the beans to make them more digestible, it's better if you just soak them overnight. I mean, I always recommend that you soak them first for about 12 hours or overnight or something, and then you will release those enzyme inhibitors, and your body will be, and the probiotics will be able to, if you're going to ferment the beans, have a much better time good and bring out all those the nutrients.
I have to ferment my beans.
Yeah. I mean, baked beans. You know, I like to ferment beans as well. And then, I mean, I sort of stay away from. I recommend organic beans, especially the soybeans, because you know you want to avoid the modified ones. But definitely, baked beans is a wonderful breakfast. And in fact, I have a fabulous recipe in there. It's one of my favorites as well. This book.
Okay, well, Deidre, thank you so much for joining me. It's all about food, and I'm going to start growing things here in my kitchen.
Wonderful. Nice talking to you. Thank you so much, Karen.
Okay, all the best. Well, you've been listening to another episode of It's All About Food. Thank you so much for joining me, and you can find me at responsibleeatingandliving.com. And send me a message at info@realmeals.org. Always love to hear from you. Okay, have a very delicious week.